Your bulletin on the very back panel has a rather expanded outline of where we're going to go. And I want to, again, just make reference to the back of the bulletin so that you can kind of see where we're going to go. We're going to begin. It's not just women who are to have powerful influence and a godly influence in an ungodly environment. But, and I want to develop that a little bit. I want to go through the Old Testament. And we're going to be looking at several people who, by doing what was right biblically, even though it was going to cost them physically and literally, there was profound influence. And in some case, national impact because of godly influence. And there's some New Testament examples we're going to look at. Then we need to define, what are we talking about here by influence? Where it says there in verse 1 of chapter 3, that they without a word might be won by your chaste conduct. How do we define that? How can we put some words, some concrete examples to that? And then we're going to look at some of the historic examples of it for this context here of 1 Peter 3, and this is just going to be review. Then we're going to look at chapter 2 just a little bit and be reminded of some of the things that Peter wrote to these strangers and aliens that were scattered abroad. Because this is not the first time that we're told to be influencing people in a godly way, even though it's an ungodly environment. He's already mentioned that a couple of times in the book so far. And then I want to end up with Abraham's submission to, Sarah's submission to Abraham. And again, reading through, as I've mentioned before, but I'm starting early this year with the Old Testament, and I'm into Genesis 40, I don't know, it doesn't matter, close to 40. As I was reading through it again, because here's what we're going to come up with. Let me just back up. Oftentimes, when we read 1 Peter 3, 1 through 5, the women usually say, but you don't know my husband. And I'm hearing giggling, so that's not too far from a statement. But you don't know my husband. Okay? I don't know your husband, at least not to the degree that you know your husband. But have you ever looked at Sarah and Abraham's relationship? Because I'm pretty certain that your husband, though he may not be the champion of husbands, he wasn't anything like Abraham. And we need to review some of the clay feet of Abraham, and yet Sarah was still willing to call him Lord. Now, not capital L-O-R-D. She wasn't worshiping him, but she still called him Lord, Master, Sovereign, the head of the house. And he was really a stinker on several occasions. So we're going to work our way through that, and then we're going to have some Christmas messages and things of that nature, and then we're going to get back into it when we come back to 1 Peter with wives. Now, likewise, and we need to work through all that again, in the way that we're supposed to respond to our government, as we're supposed to respond to our masters, as Christ was obedient and suffered to death, likewise, then you wives, and we'll deal with that in a little bit, to your husbands. So, we've already prayed, so let's get started here with the power of a godly influence in an ungodly environment. Malachi chapter 3, and I wanted to just refresh your memory of this, God is immutable. Immutable, which means God never changes. We get this from Malachi 3:6. I am the Lord, I change not. Which, by the way, is good news for you. Because since I do not change, you're not consumed. If God acted and reacted as way we oftentimes act and react, we had all been history a long time ago, and the earth probably wouldn't even exist anymore. But God never changes. His faithfulness, His long-suffering, His compassion, His mercy never changes. His holiness and His justice will never change either. So, I just want you to keep that in the back of your mind, that when God wrote this, as we look through these Old Testament examples, He's just as real and powerful in the influence of the Old Testament and the influence of the New Testament. You can have same influence here today in this century. So let's begin with some of the Old Testament examples of the power of a godly influence. Remember Noah? Remember Noah and his son? God goes to Noah and he looks down and he sees the atrocities of man and he says, my spirit is not going to dwell with man forever. In fact, you know what, Noah? You've got 120 years. And after 120 years, this is it. And it's kind of interesting in verse 8 of that, in verse 14 and verse 22, what we have is Noah said, okay, God, I'm not exactly sure how to build an ark. Never built it before. Haven't got a clue what rain is because they've never had rain yet. There's enough dew that comes up in the evening that is enough to water the vegetation. But you know what, God? I'll do it. So he grabs his son. He grabs the blueprints that God gives about how tall and how long and how wide, and he starts hammering. But because of his godly influence, well, we can't really overstate that, because if he didn't do it and if God destroyed the earth, we wouldn't be here. So there's tremendous influence that Noah had with the building of the ark. When you go back to Joseph, we start out with Joseph in Genesis chapter 39, verses 1 and 2. And he is being used by God in a very powerful way with Potiphar's house. In fact, Potiphar is recognizing this, that this Hebrew slave, literally, that he bought to be used in his household, it seems like whatever he touched, he kind of like the Midas touch. Whatever he touched, God prospered. So, you know, his master just kind of backed off and said, well, just run the whole show because you're doing a good job. Then he gets thrown into prison because he was accused of rape falsely. And as he's in prison, the jailkeeper, again, notices this one person who was condemned by this man, Potiphar, and was thrown into jail. And again, his influence is again spreading like a plague, but it's in a good way. So the jailkeeper sees that whatever Joseph's hands touch, God prospers. So the jailkeeper backs away and kind of let Joseph do his thing. And then we've got the interpretation of the dreams and everything. And then we come up to the end of the book where how many people were impacted by Joseph's influence? The whole world. The whole world was influenced by this one man that he stayed true even though his brothers sought to kill him. This one man who stayed true even though they threw him in the pit. This one man who was sold to slave traders as they went by. This one man who was thrown in jail unjustly. Because of his godly influence, he impacted the known world at that time. What about Daniel? What about Daniel? We begin with a bunch of boys stripped from their homes, as mom and dad are probably killed. The enemies come in, kill all the influential, important people of the older ones, and then they grab their children and bring them back to a foreign land to indoctrinate them and to steal the strength and the vigor and the brains of their youth. And Joseph says, you know what, we can't eat this meat and this wine that's offered to the kings. But I'll tell you what, let me give you an idea. Let's try an experiment. Tell you what, you let us eat our food and you can eat your food, and after a period of time, we'll see who looks better. And obviously, we know kind of how that story worked. And then as we go a little bit further with the lion's den, we've got, well, here, let me show you. You've got to read this. Go to Daniel chapter 6. Psalms, Proverbs, skipping a few, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, Daniel. Daniel chapter 6, beginning in verse 25. Daniel chapter 6, beginning in verse 25. This is now where Daniel's been saved out of the lion's den. And in verse 25, the king writes this, then King Darius, Daniel chapter 6, verse 25, to all people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth. How large of an influence is that? Kind of a rhetorical question. Peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in every domain of my kingdom, men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and steadfast forever. His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed. His dominion shall endure to the end. He delivers and rescues, and he works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions, So Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius, in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. One man who is going to live a godly life in an ungodly environment, and his influence went the whole world, or at least the whole Persian Empire, which was a lot of the known world at that time. What about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Back up a page or so in your Bibles to Daniel chapter 3. Daniel chapter 3. They're supposed to bow down and worship this image that the king has erected. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego says, not going to do it. The king brings them because he had invested time and money and effort into training them and grooming them to, you know, be a part of his court. And he says, you know, guys, I'll give you another time here, another chance. And they go, king, we don't need to consider this. We don't need to think about this. We're telling you, we're not going to bow down. Well, you know the story. The king superheated the furnace so that his choice men, his champions who went to throw them into the fire, were also consumed. Not only were there three men in the fire, but the king kind of looks and says, wow, there's four in this fiery furnace, and the fourth has this image of God. Well, anyway, as we come out there, we come to Daniel chapter 3, verse 28. And Nebuchadnezzar spoke and said, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him. And they would have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies, that they should not worship any god except their own. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made an ash heap, because there is no other God who can deliver like this. Three men in the very midst of an ungodly environment. They just do what is right. And God is able to take that which is right and use it to impact untold number of people. Remember Malachi chapter 3, verse 6? I am the Lord, I change not. So don't be racing in your back of your minds, oh yeah, but that was thousands of years ago and it'll never happen today. And I'll say baloney, because we'll get there in just a little bit, that it is happening today. And we're full aware of some of what which is happening today just by a few people who have given their lives to doing right in the midst of hostile circumstances. Then you got Jonah. And I know the story, and you guys know the story. Jonah wasn't too willing to go about and to go and witness to this Nineveh, this city, because there was a wicked, depraved people. But after the fish vomited Jonah out and he got right with God, what was the result of his influence? What happened to Nineveh? Did God destroy it? No. Why not? Because of Jonah. God said, buddy, go. And Jonah, it was a big city. I don't remember. It was 3 or 4 days walk just to go through the town. But he went through it. He preached the gospel. The people turned back to God, repented, and God relented and did not destroy the city. One person in a very godless environment says, you know what? I'm going to do what God tells me to do. And that's all I'm going to worry about. I'm not going to worry about anyone or anything else. I will do what God wants me to do. And the impact saved an entire city. We got Elijah. There's another one. You know the story of the Mount Carmel. And we've got the prophets of Baal. And we got kind of like the old-fashioned, real old-fashioned OK Corral. And there's this vacillating between who is God and who is not. So, you know, they kind of make a deal and say, hey, you gather all the prophets of Baal. And you try to light a fire without any fire. And you call your God, whoever that is, Baal, to come and light fire. And nothing happens. And then, you know, the story, Elijah, he rebuilds it, saturates it twice with water. In fact, there's water surrounding this offering. And Elijah basically says this, you know, God, you got to do something spectacular, that two things. They know I'm your prophet, and they know that you're God. And woof, the fire comes down and sucks up and burns up everything. There's just kind of a scorched pit in the earth. One man in a very godless environment did what was right, and the influence was huge. You cannot underestimate that. What about some New Testament examples? Let's go to Matthew chapter 3. What about some New Testament examples? What about John the Baptist? This is kind of an interesting character. Kind of dressed a little weird. Got some rough garments on. Eating a really funky diet. I mean, locusts and honey. I mean, that's real natural. I don't know if I'd go quite to that extreme, but he was kind of a curious man, and this message was kind of a curious message as well. And in Matthew chapter 3, verses 1 through 6, you kind of know the story. I just described him in verses 1 through 4, but notice verse 5. Then Jerusalem, all Judea, in all the region around Jordan, we got to look at this guy. We got to hear his message. Have you listened to this prophet called John the Baptist? No. Well, let's go. Let's go find out. Let's go listen to his message. And then verse 6, they're being baptized as well. But again, one person in a very ungodly environment. And one person is not wondering about what everyone else should or would or could do. One person is just doing what God asked them to do. And we've got, in verse 5, Jerusalem, all Judea, and all the regions around Jordan are coming to listen to just this one guy. I am the Lord, I change not. As I was able to use individuals in the Old Testament to have profound impact through godly influence, I can do the same thing in the New Testament. John the Baptist is one example. The second example is Paul and Silas. Go in your Bibles to Acts chapter 16. Just go towards the back. You got Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and then you've got Acts. Acts chapter 16. Little veggie tales there, I think. Acts chapter 16. Beginning in verse 25, but at midnight, Acts chapter 16, verse 25, but at midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the prisoners were listening to them. And then the earthquake happens, the locks and the stocks and everything break through, the keeper's about ready to kill himself, and Peter and Silas cry, Paul and Silas cry out and say, verse 26, do you no harm? You don't have to kill yourself, we're here. And then in verse 30, he brought them out and said to them, sirs, what must I do to be saved? They weren't preaching. They weren't browbeating. They weren't pigeonholing him. They were just living literally a life that had a profound influence. They were being godly. They were singing and praising God in the midst of having been beaten and thrown in jail. And someone is converted without a word. Well, singing, I guess. Then, go to Acts chapter 17. Just again, just a few pages to the back. Here you've got a couple individuals, and there's not really that many. And in this particular case, you got just Paul again, Silas, in chapter 17, verse 6. The magistrates, the people in authority are scared to death. Because in Acts chapter 17, verse 6, and when they did not find them, that would be Paul and Silas, they dragged Jason and some of the brethren to the rulers of the city, crying out, these who have turned, what did they do? I tell you what, you and I can never underestimate the power of a godly influence in an ungodly environment. You know, as it says in the Old Testament, I sought for a man who would stand in the gap. God is still looking for individuals who will just do what He asked them to do. And I know you're in an ungodly environment. Hey, I live here in Lower Bucks too. I read the paper. I know what's going on in this world. I'm not completely isolated from you. We don't believe in the separation of, you know, the clergy and the laity. I'm in the trenches with you. But I also know that God is a God who does not change. And if you will but do what is right and trust Him, He will use you like He used other people. Noah, Joseph, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, Jonah, Elijah, John the Baptist, Paul and Silas. Hey, here's one that we don't even really need to talk about. What about Jesus Christ? Just one person. A very obscure, boring, nondescript man. Just one individual who did what was right. And again, there's no way we could begin to tell about the influence of this one man. Never underestimate the influence of a godly person in an ungodly environment. Now, I know you're all thinking the same thing. Old Testament, man, that was the old dispensation. And there's an element of truth to that. God worked in the Old Testament in ways that He doesn't necessarily work today in the New Testament. And yes, I know you guys were talking about, or I've been talking about, you know, John the Baptist and the apostles and the sent out ones, and there are no apostles today, so where's the influence? One of the privileges that I've had over the years is to really be able to sit down with Fred and Trudy Vermeulen and listen to their story. And I know we're kind of missionary hogs, and we jealously like that title, but we are maybe willing to begrudgingly let some of you have them in your home. Because the missionaries we have are absolutely the bestest whole missionaries in the whole wide world. And to be able to sit there and listen to Fred and Trudy tell the story of how in 1965-ish, when they first went to Suriname, these Indians were killing each other. They were still having tribal warfare. No Bible, no nothing. And the influence that Fred and Trudy had, not just with the Indians, but also with the former presidents that they've had, the Department of Education. This man, by himself, this man primarily has been the most influential man for God in the whole Suriname country. And had not this man been there, we would not know Suriname as it is today. And as you just heard earlier, for 19 years now, he's been working on translating the Bible. What influence will those Bibles bring about in the weeks, years, decades to come? In this case, two individuals. Two individuals who are willing to do right. Now, it does cost. And as you listen to Trudy with her horrible arthritis, the rheumatoid arthritis, have you been noticing her fingers and knuckles lately? I mean, this woman is crippled to the max, and yet every year she goes down in that cold, damp jungle every morning, has to get up, put hot water on her hands to get them moving, and yet she's up cooking Fred and myself breakfast every morning. There is a price to be paid. But when you look at the payment that Fred and Trudy have paid, and the payoff, there are still villages there in Suriname that are dry. They will not let any alcohol into their villages. You know why? Fred and Trudy have taught them. Just a couple of individuals. Current. We're not talking the Old Testament saints. We're not necessarily talking New Testament saints. We're not talking about William Carey or Johnny Erickson. We're talking about real life people that you guys have shook their hands, prayed with, had them in your homes. You fed them. You've ate with them. They're no different than you. And if you and I will do what's right, God will use that in huge, powerful ways. What would be the definition of godly influence? Go back to 1 Peter, right near the very end of your Bible. Go back to 1 Peter. And we're going to see it there in 1 Peter chapter 3. The bottom half of verse 1 and the first part of verse 2. 1 Peter chapter 3. Okay, so I've been talking now for 20 minutes about godly influence. Don't you think it's about time we defined it? Me too. Let's do it. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 1 says, "Wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word," here we go, "they, without a word, may be won by the conduct of their wives when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied with fear." Now, it's not only the wives who are supposed to do this. Look at 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 14. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 14 says, as obedient children, not fashioning or not conforming yourselves to the former lust in your ignorance. As obedient children, not conforming yourselves to the former lust. A godly influence, doing what God wants you to do. Go to chapter 2, verse 12. Chapter 2, verse 12. Verse 11 says, beloved, I beg you as soldiers and pilgrims, abstain from the fleshly lusts which war against your soul. Notice what verse 12 says. Having your conduct what? Before whom? The unsaved. The unsaved. Those who are hostile towards the gospel. Those who are in this ungodly environment. You are to have conduct that is honorable among the Gentiles. Notice verse 15. Of chapter 2. What is God's will for you and I here today? Here's one little truth that we can all wrap around. God's will for you today is verse 15. For this is the will of God, that by doing good, you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men, those who are falsely accusing you. So it's not just women who are married to men who disobey the word, are supposed to be influencing them through godliness, but it's you and I. We are all to be doing it. So it's basically living a daily life which pleases God. Contorting our daily life to the commandments of Scripture. It's basically doing what God tells us to do and not doing what God tells us not to do. And if we would but do that, the influence is huge. Okay, let me give you a little bit of the historical setting now for this First Peter book that was written. Again, it was written from Rome, and it was written somewhere around AD 64, 65. So it was written about, and I'm rounding figures here, but about 30 or so years after Jesus died. Okay, Rome. He's writing in Rome. Nero kind of had a bad day and inadvertently let this the city caught fire by his mistake, and he burned down the whole city of Rome. Many, many people lost their lives, and everyone lost everything they had when Rome burned. So now, as you and I would say, well, who did this? We've got to point our finger somewhere. Well, Nero wasn't going to say, oh, sorry about that, guys. Threw that match out, wasn't paying attention. He took his finger and says, you know those Christians? You know those fanatics, those of the way, is them. They did it. So you can imagine the hostility and the rage of Rome and the citizens of it to the citizens at Rome. And as we know, the persecution was continuing to fan out like a fire. So those of you that are in Macedonia and in the furthermost parts of the region, Paul is writing them saying, hey guys, it's coming to you. It's going to come to you. So Paul's letter then was to encourage them. To encourage them that, number one, they were not to lose hope. And that's what 1 Peter 1, 4 through 9 is all about. He's saying, listen, you have a lasting heritage. You have a living hope. You have a loving helper. You have this heritage that's undefiled, that fadeth not away, reserved in heaven for you. So therefore you can greatly rejoice. Though now for just a little while, you're in heaviness. Because of this purposeful suffering. As you see there, he wanted to strengthen them in chapter 1, verse 13 and verse 17. He wanted to prevent them from becoming bitter or retaliating. And you can see there three times now in this book, he says, if someone reviles you, you are not to revile back. If someone threatens you, you're not supposed to be threatening back. If someone hits you, you're not supposed to be. If someone swears at you, you're not supposed to be swearing at them back. If someone has corrupt communication coming out of their mouth, you kind of get the idea here. And in that Paul, or Peter said it three times in this short book, he sees the danger of retaliating kind for kind. He's saying, listen, brothers and sisters, you can't do that. You can't do that. You are to be a godly person in the midst of an ungodly environment. And the ungodly environment is going to throw ungodliness at you. But because you have been begotten again, because you are a unique and a peculiar people, a chosen royal priesthood, you are to act like it. And we don't return reviling or threatening. We're just like Jesus Christ. And we say, God, are you taking notes here? Now, of course, we don't say that if we're messing up. But don't you guys say in the midst of difficulties, God, are you taking notes? God, do you see? God, will you reward? But we are like Jesus Christ, who committed our lives, our souls, to Him that judges righteously. So the revilings may come, the threatenings may come, the blows may still come, but we're going to do what's right. Because God does see. God is not deaf. God is not dumb. And God will reward to each man according to their works. And then number four, he just tried to encourage them to embrace the idea that by living an obedient and unique life in these hostile situations, you and I can do more than just hang in there. And I understand that when he asked someone, ah, we're just hanging in there, that's just an idea. But as you can see it on the screen, that's not why Jesus Christ lived and died, so that we can just muddle through life. Jesus Christ did not live and die so we can just hang in there. Why did Jesus Christ come? He says, I've come that you might have life and have it just hanging in there. Yeah, we're just getting by. Yeah, you know, we're right on the edge of death and despair. Ah, boy, I don't know. It really stinks, you know. I've come that you might have life and have it more abundantly. But that goes back to the first chapter where we have to, again, put our values and have our right mindset so we can greatly rejoice. The subject matter, number four here, for the godly influence. Chapter 2, verse 1. Peter again tells these people, he says, therefore, and you have to tie that back up to the previous chapter, 1, verse 22, where it says, since then you have purified your souls. And how did we purify our souls? What does chapter 1, verse 22 say? In obeying the truth. And specifically in loving the brethren unhypocritically, fervently serving and loving one another. Back to chapter 2, verse 1. Therefore, lay aside all malice and all deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and every single word that would be characterized as corrupt. And again, if I were Peter, I think I could accurately say, I don't care this situation. And I don't care what they said. I don't care what they did. And you know what? I don't even care what they didn't do. You need to do what's right. And I'm telling you, since you have purified your souls in obeying the truth, therefore, verse 1 comes into play of chapter 2. That malice, that deceit, the hypocrisy, all that emotion, all that drama, and that sewage that so quickly comes out of your mouth, be done with it. Be done with it. Put that off. Verses 11 and 12, there needs to be respect for purity as well. And if we're going to become influential beings, well, let's just stop for a minute. Let me just give you another aside. Realistically, in the environment that you find yourself in, being ungodly, is it going to get any better anytime soon? We don't believe that we're in the kingdom now, as some beliefs do, and we need to work real hard to make the kingdom suitable for the Messiah to come. There are some that think that we need to usher in the kingdom by all this goodness. We don't believe that. It just isn't going to work. All right, so our circumstances, they're not going to get any better anyway, right? So now we have two options, don't we? We can take God at His word and try to breathe that brilliant light, that pungent salt, the true ambassador of Jesus Christ that can, as Paul says, follow me as I follow Christ. This is the way, walk ye in it, as we just live our lives, and maybe we can draw them to a relationship with Jesus Christ. Or when we're reviled, we can revile, we can threaten. When they curse us, we can curse them. And you know what? We are so good at pushing people's buttons. And I'll tell you what, to demean to make fun of, to just hurt, we're skilled at that. I mean, that just comes naturally. But the environment's, it's still there. But when it's all said and done and we have to stand before God, we're going to have two radical Bema Seat, you know, operations here. And I'm not talking necessarily about sin. I'm talking about the losing of rewards. And the wood, the hay, the straw is burned up. You will be saved, yet so as by fire. So the subject matter, capital A there on number 5, there needs to be respect for purity. As we go a little bit further in chapter 2, there needs to be respect for authority. Citizens to the government, yes, even Rome. We need to be under authority of the government. Yes, even to a slave, to a master. Even to the crooked ones, the harsh ones. If your study Bible has some notations there regarding the master, scolios, from which we get scoliosis, the ones that have the curved spine, these bosses are crooked. And you need to be obeying them. Number 3, relationship of Jesus Christ to the Father's will. Remember in the Garden of Eden? He didn't want to die. The human part. 3 times he says, I don't want to do this. Let this cup pass from me. And what did Jesus say though at the end of that prayer? Nevertheless, not my will, but yeah, yours be done. And then we got the wife's relationship to her husband. And yes, even if he is disobedient. Let me give you this real quick and then I will be done. Because I do want to finish this, and this will be a good place to stop. Sarah, let's do a little history lesson about Abraham. Because in 1 Peter chapter 1, it talks about, you know, wives, you need to be submitting to your husbands like Sarah did to Abraham. A little bit about Abraham. Genesis chapter 12. Abraham comes home one day and he says, Sarah, we're leaving. Where? I don't know. Well, how long are we going to be gone? Well, I don't know. Well, how much food? I mean, I got a plan. I mean, how many diapers? How many? Well, they're not babies yet. Not for a while yet. But we got all these houses and servants and people and you're bringing your lot too. I mean, there's a lot of logistical stuff here. Where are we going? How long? I don't know, but we're going. Wives, if your husbands came to you after the service and said, hon, sell everything, quit your job, we're going. Where? I don't know. For what? I don't know. But come follow me. Wives, would that be an easy sell? Sarah did it. Your husbands haven't done that to you yet. Yet. So now as they're traveling on 2 different occasions, Sarah's a beautiful woman. In fact, she is so strikingly beautiful, Abraham gets into this deal now with his wife, his beloved, the one flesh, and says, you know what, honey? If they think that you're my wife, they're going to kill me. So here's what I want you to do. You tell them, you're my sister. And you go into the king's harem and do all that kind of stuff so I can live, okay? Really nice knowing you, hon. Goodbye. 2 times he did that. So wives, have your husbands told you to go live with another man? Abraham did it twice. And yet, oh, here's another one, which I just found out again this week. When Ishmael and Hagar were kicked out of the home. Now, we got to back up a little bit. Abraham and Lot have so many animals that the ground cannot sustain them. So Abraham says, you go any way you want to and I'll go the other way. So Lot, he pitched his tent towards Sodom and then Abraham went the other way. So we're talking a man that has massive wealth, right? When he kicks Hagar and his own son out of the camp, what did he send them away with? Any of you remember? Yeah. He gave them some food and a skin of water. Now, I could understand maybe the Hagar, the mistress, maybe he's not too favorable for him and we'll throw her out. But your own son? You're going to do that to your own son? You're not going to send him away with any camels, no cattle, no sheep, no goats, no money, no servants. You're sending away with nothing but some food and a skin of water? You know, wives, if your husbands were to say, we're kicking the kid out and we're not giving up anything, nothing, that'd be tough, wouldn't it? And yet Sarah, as we see there in 1 Peter 3, verse 6, called him Lord. Called him Master. Called him the boss. And she submitted himself to her. Applications. What do we do with this? And again, you're saying, yeah, but Scogan, you don't know my circumstances. You're right, I don't. But look at chapter 2, verse 23. Chapter 2, verse 23 says what? He did not threaten, but committed himself to him, being God, that judges righteously. We haven't got there yet, but turn the page to chapter 4, verse 19. Chapter 4, 19. Therefore, let those who suffer according to the will of God commit their souls to Him in doing good as a faithful Creator. So you're right. I absolutely do not know your husband, but God does. And God is saying, rest in my sovereignty. Rest in my sovereignty. Number two, focus not on your circumstances. Don't focus on the people that are involved in your life. Focus on your conduct. You're a chosen people. He has called you out of darkness. He has called you into His marvelous light. Yield. We're going to have to yield to the authorities in our life, whatever they may be. The pattern is yielding. Fear. Fear. Chapter 1, verse 7 says, since there is a God who is going to judge without partiality, we better conduct the days of our lives here in fear. Now, we're not supposed to fear the ungodly environment. Who or what are we supposed to fear? God. Our God. We're to fear the examination of our life. And then just flee. Flee those fleshly lusts. When you're living in an ungodly environment and your sinful fleshness is starting to come to the surface, you need to get rid of them. You need to flee the fleshly lusts which do war against your soul. So application, you have them there on the bottom of your bulletin. You need to rest in the sovereignty of God. Focus not on anyone or anything else but you. God is using this for your good. Yield to the authorities. Follow the example of Jesus Christ. Fear and then flee. Never, never underestimate your ability to have untold powerful influence as a godly individual in an ungodly environment. Heads bowed.